Welcome to Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower. After a bit of a break, Hannah and I are thrilled to be back and with a terrific guest for today. Ankit Panda is the Stanton Senior Fellow in the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is an expert on the Asia-Pacific region and has authored many publications on this topic, including his book, Kim Jong-un and the Bomb, Survival and Deterrence in North Korea. Ankit, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me. Super excited to be here.
Great. Well, let me jump in with our first question here, which deals with this book that I just mentioned. It covers, you know, the history of North Korea's quest for nuclear weapons, and it came out in 2020, so nearly 4 years ago now. For those in our audience who maybe haven't had a chance to read your book, could you start by telling us a little bit about, you know, some of the central arguments that you promote, and then also the extent to which they remain valid today? You know, what has changed and what has remained the same in those intervening 4 years since publication?
Sure. Yeah, thanks, Sarah. That's a great place to start. So the book is basically the first attempt to distill North Korea's approach to putting together a nuclear force structure and strategy. So there's been other books written about the history, and there is a chapter in the book about the history, of course, because just to bring a reader up to speed. But the purpose of the book really wasn't to relitigate 30 years of non-proliferation history. By the time I was writing this book, I was of the firm belief that North Korea had moved from the category of being a non-proliferation problem to a problem of nuclear deterrence more broadly, and so that's what the book tries to do. It explains the key qualitative benchmarks that the North Koreans thought were essential for them to acquire what they saw as a credible nuclear deterrent, and so there's a lot of kind of very wonky detail on their development of delivery systems. And the nice thing about when I was writing this was, this was in the period of diplomacy that took place in 2018 and 2019. So the North Koreans largely stopped testing things, which is a very nice thing for an author trying to write a book. And, I was happy that the North Koreans weren't producing more data that I had to incorporate. So that's what the book does. I will say, as an author, the chapter I probably had the most fun writing was a chapter actually on command and control, which is an issue that at the time I was writing it, very few people had done any work on. And so I really thought that was a fun thing to delve into. And the nice thing about the issue of nuclear strategy in general is that it's quite rare that once countries have identified the core strategic imperatives for them to seek nuclear weapons and to develop a force structure and a strategy, that things change. So to answer your question about what has changed, you know, I argue that the broad contours of North Korean nuclear strategy haven't changed. The big development since I wrote the book has been, and I'm happy to get into more detail on this, the North Koreans have announced a pretty broad-ranging nuclear modernization plan, but also they've identified a need for tactical nuclear weapons. A couple things that I basically predicted they would do in the book, some things like a rail mobile basing for ballistic missiles, they did very shortly after I published, and I felt a little guilty, but maybe that's taking too much credit. The core arguments, I think, stand up. What I see the North Koreans doing now is broadly fleshing out the nuclear strategy that they articulated almost more than 15 years ago now. They articulated a strategy long before they had the forces to render that strategy credible. I'm hoping potentially I'll get to do a second edition at some point once their modernization plans coalesce or at least reach some kind of intermission, so to speak.
Ankit, you just mentioned North Korea's nuclear modernization program being sort of brought to fruition. More broadly, we seem to have started the year with a number of alarming news coming out of the Korean Peninsula, with Kim seemingly adopting a more aggressive posture. He declared South Korea the principal enemy, and he seems to be testing some new weapon system on an almost daily basis. So if we look ahead into the course of 2024 and into the future, I want to ask you, what are some of the potential developments that you are most concerned about that we could see over the coming weeks or months?
Sure. So from the perspective of peace and security on the Korean Peninsula, I think the thing I worry about most is the potential for a skirmish or a provocation, to use the term that's rather popular, at least in the South Korean press. This is essentially describing a loss of life on the Korean Peninsula resulting from violence initiated by North Korea, the sort of thing we haven't seen on the Korean Peninsula actually under Kim Jong-un. You'd have to go all the way back to 2010, 1 year before his father died, to see, I think, an example of what I'm describing. And of course, 2010 is not 2024. In 2010, North Korea had tested a nuclear device, but certainly didn't have anything resembling the nuclear forces it does today. And so one of the concerns is that Kim, as a result of his newfound confidence in his nuclear capabilities, will feel that he has the ability to resort to conventional violence, basically an iteration of the stability and instability paradox, right? This idea that because the United States and South Korea recognize that escalation with North Korea carries the danger of potential nuclear war, that there may be a greater possibility of engaging in conventional violence below that threshold. Now, what I just described, I don't think applies to how many people in the South Korean government think about the problem. And so in South Korea, there is, I think, a strong emphasis right now on strongly and disproportionately retaliating against North Korea to reestablish deterrence, in effect. And of course, while that logic might sound alluring, in practice, I think it does raise the question of what are the risks of inadvertent escalation on the Korean Peninsula? I think this is a serious problem that merits quite a bit of consideration. How do you manage escalation with North Korea? And these are some of the questions that I'm thinking about now in the course of some of the work that I'm doing. But I think that is the most important short-term consequence. You know, Hana, you talked a bit about Kim's testing and modernization. That to me today, you know, what he's doing is interesting to me as an analyst of North Korea. But compared to what was happening in 2016 and 2017, I think every individual test event that we now see in North Korea, broadly speaking, I think marginally helps us understand what the North Koreans are trying to do. But none of what's happened, I would argue, is really a game changer. I mean, even the tactical nuclear weapons, the North Koreans always maintained a low threshold for nuclear use. It's simply that the acquisition of some of the new capabilities that they've been testing simply opens up a wider range of scenarios that we have to think about.
Ankit, you just mentioned Kim's newfound confidence. Now, that newfound confidence might also partially be a product of a development that we haven't yet talked about, and that is North Korea's qualitatively changing relationship with Russia. Now, as we know, over the last 6 months or so, Russia has procured ammunition and short-range ballistic missiles from North Korea. And there is a lot of concern about what Russia might give the North Koreans in return for such support. Some are quite alarmed about the prospect of Russia giving, for instance, support to North Korea's ICBM program or support it in terms of nuclear propulsion. But there doesn't seem to be a consensus in the expert community in terms of how likely such support could materialize. You know, some are quite alarmed, and then others argue, well, the Russians are not going to give away their quote unquote crown jewels to the North Koreans. I'm wondering, what is your take on that debate and what we might see in terms of the contours of future Russia DPRK cooperation?
Yeah, no, this is absolutely a critical issue, something that I and a lot of other analysts are watching very closely. There is, I think, a full-fledged strategic partnership taking hold between Russia and North Korea. In many ways, the way I sort of think about the big picture here is that, in a way, this represents the greatest opportunity strategically for North Korea in decades. I think as tragic as the collapse of the Soviet Union was for Kim Il-sung, I think the current embrace between Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un is as great of an opportunity for North Korea. That's a pretty hyperbolic statement, but I do mean that. I mean, there's quite a bit that the North Koreans get here. Specifically on the questions of technical assistance, I mean, analytically, I think I find myself potentially closer to the latter group of analysts that you described. Not in the sense that I completely dismiss the idea of even concerning ourselves with, you know, these kinds of transfers. I think certainly it's good to be remain vigilant. But I do think while there is a strategic partnership, as we know from, you know, our own alliances in the West, alliances or partnerships are often based on a give and take logic. There are quid pro quos that ultimately have to be bartered on the basis of cost and benefit. And I think the Russians ultimately do have some leverage to deny the North Koreans access to certain categories of technology, or at least exact a higher cost from the North Koreans for certain categories of technology. So when it comes to, for instance, nuclear weapons design information, which I think would be the most significant category of technology transfer between the two countries, you know, I think there are a lot of things that the Russians would be able to convince the North Koreans that they can benefit from before having to get to that point, right? So even something as simple, and this isn't really simple, but, you know, in the non-nuclear domain, something like surface-to-air missiles, right? it doesn't seem that exciting, but meaningfully, that could actually make a significant difference for the North Koreans. They haven't had a real capability for a number of decades to deal with potentially air-based threats. And of course, systems like the S-300, the North Koreans have an analog. If the Russians were able to help them with the seeker technology or the kill vehicle technology for surface-to-air missiles, that actually makes quite a big difference for the North Koreans. And it's way below, I think, the threshold of voluntarily transferring ICBM technologies or nuclear weapons design information. But a related category, I think, is the transfer of raw materials or composite materials to actually allow the North Koreans to continue cranking out missiles for use by Russia on the battlefields of Ukraine, but also for the North Koreans to increase their own confidence in mass producing missiles, tighten up their manufacturing tolerances, improve the overall reliability of their systems. I think all of this is part of how the North Koreans will continue to benefit. And I'm sure the North Koreans have been quite interested in collecting data from the battlefields of Ukraine, which actually marked the first ever use of North Korea manufactured ballistic missiles in an actual war.
Ankit, this is so helpful for getting a sense for kind of the bigger picture of what we can expect next. I want to bring in something we touched upon a little bit earlier, which is testing and specifically nuclear testing. As we know, North Korea hasn't conducted any nuclear weapons tests since 2017, sort of in line with this, you know, self-declared moratorium that Kim announced. But Russia's recent de-ratification of the CTBT and increased, you know, nuclear test activity at sites in China, Russia, even the US, they've raised concerns among some sectors about, you know, the resumption of nuclear testing and potential cascading effects that could follow from that. So this idea that, you know, if Russia were to test, for instance, you know, the US and China might follow suit. Help us understand what this means for North Korea. Are there pressures on North Korea to test? Might testing become technologically necessary for them given the kinds of capabilities they're working on, or is that not really a concern at present?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. I mean, you know, I think there's two separate issues there, because as an analyst, I'm certainly very concerned by, I think, what you described, you know, implicit in your question is concern about the fraying of the norm against nuclear testing among the major powers, or at least the concerning level of activity that we observe at test sites in Russia, China, and to a much lesser degree, I would argue, the United States, but still some level of activity and readiness. So let me answer this by suggesting that for the North Koreans, I think these issues surrounding norms more generally are far less of a restraint than we might think, right? They are the only country to have conducted nuclear testing in the 21st century. They're the only country to have ever withdrawn from the NPT. And so I think at the margins, it could make something of a difference for the North Koreans to consider testing. But I think ultimately their decision to test or not to test will come down to political factors pertaining to their relationship primarily with China, I would argue, and to the perceived technological benefits of testing. And with regard to the latter, you know, I do think they will test. I think Kim Jong-un, generally speaking, you know, there's this idea that North Korea is incredibly opaque and difficult to predict, but Kim actually has this habit of telling us what he's going to do, and then he usually does it. And especially when he publicly commits to some kind of technical objective, the North Koreans will follow up. And so he has committed to develop better nuclear warheads and tactical nuclear warheads in his plenum speech, or sorry, party Congress speech in January 2021, which was when he outlined this five-year plan of military modernization that is ongoing. So that five-year plan should conclude around early 2026 at the next party Congress. And so this is, in a way, you know, Chekhov's gun. So, you know, in act one of this modernization five-year or five-act play, whatever you want to call it, you know, he raises the prospect of nuclear testing. And my belief is that before the five-year plan concludes, we will see that test. We've seen evidence that the test site that they had reversibly dismantled in the course of the diplomacy in 2018 has been reassembled, brought to a level of readiness where they could test on rather short notice. I think there's an interesting debate to be had about why they haven't tested to date. One of the most persuasive explanations I've heard is that the frenzy about testing was highest around the time of the Chinese Party Congress, which I think would have been a rather inopportune time for the North Koreans to test. And so I do suspect there was some level of Chinese political pressure that caused Kim Jong-un to potentially delay this test. At the same time, the North Koreans have substituted, you know, when it comes to the signaling value or even the internal propaganda value of nuclear testing, we have seen, I think, activities in North Korea that could be read as substitutes for nuclear testing, right? So these include a higher frequency of military parades, Kim Jong-un very overtly guiding military officials in the course of tactical nuclear weapons use planning. He has inspected a claimed tactical nuclear device flanked by military officers as well. But I think, you know, this is going to lead to that point where they do test. I know I just used Chekhov's gun analogy from theater, but to borrow from music, I mean, you could also think of this modernization as a symphony. And in the final movement, Kim is looking for a crescendo. And so the nuclear test, I think, is going to provide that. There's also the issue of multiple reentry vehicles, which are, you know, multiple reentry vehicles and nuclear testing. Those are the two things that I am still expecting to see as part of this modernization plan that we haven't yet seen. So I think those are the two big ones.
I love it. This is bringing in, you know, we often talk about the importance of sort of multidisciplinarity in the work that we do. So we've got, you know, the hard security issues, we've got art and music. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, this issue of norms that you just brought up in your previous response. You know, one thing that constrains countries pursuing a nuclear weapons capability is norms. Another thing might be risk reduction measures, more formal measures. You have argued for some time now that the North Korean nuclear problem is no longer a question of kind of short-term disarmament, but rather of long-term risk reduction. So I'm curious to hear whether that argument is more widely accepted today, maybe than when you first made it in your book 4 years ago. And if so, kind of what kinds of concrete risk reduction measures do you think would be effective? What do you have in mind here with that?
Yeah, that's something very near and dear to me. I think I started making a version of this argument probably as early as late 2016 for the first time, because I was concerned that the North Koreans would test an ICBM in 2017. And I was making the argument at the time that it's probably a good thing to stop the North Koreans before they cross some of those thresholds. And so we can limit the scope of this problem. And the problem has become a lot more unbounded and of course, the North Koreans aren't picking up the phone, and so engagement is very difficult. But I continue to think, you know, the principle behind the argument is still sound. Essentially, the way I put it is this, right? For three decades plus, the core principle at the heart of U.S., South Korean, Japanese, even, you know, European policy towards North Korea has been denuclearization, the idea that this is a proliferator that has crossed key thresholds, built nuclear weapons. This is a terrible thing for the international non-proliferation order. Therefore, the North Korean nuclear program must be put back in the box. And I don't disagree with any of those kind of normative observations about the fact that this is a uniquely terrible challenge for the global non-proliferation order. Although I would argue from where we're sitting today in 2024 compared to 2016 or earlier, North Korea perhaps is not the only threat to that order, or even as significant of a threat to that order as it was a while ago. But the key principle that should guide our policy today, I think, and this sounds rather uncontroversial, but of course it's not the basis of our policy, you know, it should be the prevention of nuclear war. That this is a country with tens of nuclear warheads. We can talk about estimates about how many warheads they actually have, but they have nuclear warheads that we know work. They have delivery systems. We know that U.S. intelligence community, at least, has repeatedly assessed those capabilities to be credible, that their warheads can be mated with their missiles. And so these are real capabilities that can be brought to bear in a crisis or a war. And so reducing the risk of nuclear war is obviously central to U.S. and allied interests, but yet it is not the basis on which we form our policy. And so I think that really should be where we go. And you know, to answer your question, this is a lot less controversial of an idea than it was several years ago. It's something that I regularly now talk to officials about. There's this frustrating observation that I walk away with from many of the meetings I have in Seoul, Washington, elsewhere on North Korea policy, which is that many of the people in government working these issues, I think, intellectually agree that North Korea is very unlikely to disarm in the short term, and there are real risks advancing you know, as we speak, but yet it's very difficult to move us away from denuclearization, because ultimately that would require the expenditure of political capital, probably at the level of the president here in the United States, similarly in South Korea, and that's politically costly. You know, you also hear the argument that, and not to open another can of worms in our podcast today, but South Korea is a country now where, you know, more than 70% of the public regularly is polled in favor of developing an independent nuclear deterrent. And so the concern is, well, what if we move towards risk reduction, then that's implicitly accepting North Korea's status, at least as a nuclear weapons possessor. And that's going to send a bad signal to the South Korean public, so on and so forth. And I think that's an entirely reasonable way to look at this problem. But again, I would argue that the future of proliferation on the Korean Peninsula by South Korea is uncertain, but what we know today for sure is that there are unbounded risks of nuclear use stemming from the completely unconstrained relationship we have with North Korea, devoid of risk reduction, arms control, the last piece of conventional arms control between South Korea and North Korea, the Comprehensive Military Agreement of 2018, is now basically completely scrapped, well, officially scrapped by North Korea, basically almost officially scrapped by South Korea. So in this environment, I think there's really a need to think about risk reduction. So I spoke for a while. I didn't actually get to any of the to the specific recommendations I have, but I just wanted to stop there in case you wanted me to follow up on any of that.
Yeah, I think that would be great. It would be, I mean, before we jump into the next question, I'd love to hear some of the specific recommendations that you have. I think that's really helpful for people, myself included, in kind of conceiving the art of the possible with North Korea. I have a good sense for what that might look like with, you know, U.S.-Russia relations, for example, but with North Korea, where, as you indicated, the relationship is so frayed, contact is so limited, where does one begin to have this conversation?
Yeah, so, you know, in terms of where does one begin, I think my views have changed, just given, again, the art of the possible with North Korea, right? So realistically, as an analyst, I have to account for the fact that while it's fun to come up with all kinds of interesting arms control proposals, like bringing North Koreans out to Guam to inspect, you know, the New START conversions of B-1B bombers to verify that they're non-nuclear, that's ultimately probably not something that's going to be feasible in the current geopolitical environment. So lately, I've actually been drawn to a category of measures that I think of as risk reduction that I would broadly describe, and this is sometimes a dirty word in DC, as unilateral, right? But let me clarify what I mean by unilateral, because I mean these are measures that I think don't actually compromise deterrence of North Korea, which I again do care about, but actually reduce, in my view, the unnecessary risks of nuclear war that we might have to tolerate in a crisis, right? So specific measures here, I think, include on the U.S. side, you know, the policy that the United States maintains of comprehensive missile defeat, which includes non-kinetic left-of-launch measures to interfere with North Korea's potential command and control systems for nuclear forces, which, as the United States and the Soviet Union learned very early in the Cold War, is a very good way to get a limited nuclear war to go unlimited. Or to give the other side very little reason to hold back because they might fear the ability that their ability to exercise control over their nuclear forces will be compromised in the course of a war. And I think the non-kinetic component is especially important because amid the stresses, psychological and otherwise, of a crisis, Kim Jong-un is going to have very little ability to perceive whether an inbound cyber attack or some other kind of kinetic attack on his command and control may be imminent, right? Physical attacks have some evidence, at least, of force generation, which now the North Koreans have a satellite, so maybe they can even see some of that happening, but non-kinetic attacks don't. And I think that's a pretty unwise policy by the United States. I think the deterrence juice is not worth the squeeze. Sorry, I keep throwing out all these terrible metaphors, but I think the risks that come with that are significant. And on the South Korean side, I see some real problems with Seoul's strategy, broadly speaking, since roughly 2012 to 2015 of beginning to amass a set of capabilities that amount basically to a conventional counterforce strategy. So this includes investments in precision missiles, enabling technologies to preemptively destroy North Korean nuclear-capable missile launchers, and in the aftermath of North Korean nuclear use, decapitating Kim Jong-un, ending his regime. And while those measures could enhance deterrence under some circumstances, they also, I would argue, significantly increase inadvertent nuclear use risks, very much for the same reasons that non-kinetic interference with command and control does. Kim is going to have concerns about his ability to use his nuclear forces before they might be preemptively destroyed in a crisis, creating what Thomas Schelling, of course, described as the reciprocal fear of surprise attack, where you have a preemptive loop where the North Koreans want to go first, the South Koreans want to go first. Each of them knows the other wants to go first, and therefore one of them will go first. And that's a very good way to end up in a nuclear war that presumably all of these conventional counterforce capabilities were designed to deter in the first place. And so adapting at least signaling towards North Korea that suggests that South Korea and the United States will not have an itchy trigger finger, at least when it comes to preemption, but will have the capability to deny North Korea the advantages of using nuclear weapons. And I think this is starting to happen. There's a lot of thinking happening within the alliance right now on what North Korea's tactical nuclear weapons frankly mean. As we're having this discussion, there are exercises on the Korean Peninsula that are thinking through some of these scenarios. You know, it wasn't actually until late 2017, early 2018 that the alliance started doing exercises simulating nuclear use by North Korea. So this is a new problem. But, you know, that's just a couple of the recommendations that I would make. Why I like these recommendations, you know, they are incredibly feasible in the short term. The North Koreans do not have to pick up the phone in order for the United States and South Korea to adapt their own military planning and strategies to, again, maintain deterrence of North Korea, but reduce some of the unnecessary risks that accompany the existing deterrence posture that we have.
This is great, Ankit. I do want to zone out a little bit as we move towards the end of our conversation and ask you about some of the wider implications of the North Korean story. So when Kim Jong-un inherited the leadership after Kim Jong-il passed away in December 2011, I suppose North Korea was still a borderline nuclear aspirant. And then some 6 years later, by late 2017, you know, Kim is really leading a nuclear power that's armed with ICBMs capable of holding the territory of the United States at risk. I wonder what you think North Korea's transition, you know, its transition to becoming a de facto nuclear weapon state means for how we should think about the problems posed by so-called nuclear threshold countries, like arguably Iran is one today. What does the North Korean experience suggest in terms of both do's and don'ts for dealing with nuclear threshold countries?
That's a really good question. I think it's one that I certainly will have to give a lot more thought to. But to sort of offer you, I guess, my first draft of a response, I think what's really fascinating about the North Korea case that I contrast with some other cases of new nuclear states that I also know somewhat well, India and Pakistan being a couple at least, is that in the North Korean case, I think the strong emphasis on the credibility of nuclear deterrence, I think really stands out. Right. This was a country that Richard Nixon very famously in the 1970s dismissed as a fourth-rate pipsqueak. You can in my book, I sort of go back and I look at the many cultural touchstones in American society, from late night shows to the New Yorker magazine to the media, even President Trump and other U.S. presidents, you know, dismissing North Korea as a country that frankly is a bit of a joke, that they'll never have the ability to threaten the United States. You know, there's this leaked transcript of a phone call that Trump had with former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, where he comments in early 2017, right before they test the ICBMs, that, you know, this Kim guy, you know, his missiles keep crashing. I think there were a few missile failures right before he had that phone call. But so for the North Koreans, I think for the longest time, they needed the United States, especially after the invasion of Iraq, which coincides with the collapse of the agreed framework. Right. So for me, by the way, I think that the first 6 months of 2003 are basically the moment where nuclearization for North Korea goes from a somewhat experimental post-Cold War endeavor, where they're not really all the way in politically on the decision to build the bomb, although they are certainly experimenting with plutonium reprocessing as early as the early 90s and later uranium enrichment with AQ Khan's help. But by the time they've decided to build the bomb, they have a very different approach to thinking about credibility. Sig Hecker, who's of course been to North Korea multiple times, he has that great anecdote about being handed a jar of Delta Phase plutonium when he visits Yongbyon in 2010. He's told that this is North Korea's deterrent. And, you know, he tells the North Koreans that, you know, this is not a deterrent. In order for a deterrent to be credible, you know, there's all these additional things that have to happen. And so the North Koreans, I think, take that to heart. I'm not blaming Sig for North Korea's nuclear program, but they do ultimately begin to emphasize these capabilities. Now, Iran, I think, is another case that I think about a lot. And I think I think, you know, you're right. I basically think of Iran today as a threshold state, arguably a state benefiting from some of the benefits of non-weaponized deterrence, as I think we observe in the South Asian case, right, where we don't actually have to assemble and detonate a bomb to necessarily gain all of the political benefits that come from credible nuclear deterrence. So I think it's a bit of a different case in that way. Of course, what's interesting with the Iranians is the sophistication of their delivery systems, the Project Ahmad work that we know that they've done on weaponization. So in terms of their threshold status, and of course, I think the unique nuclear circumstances in the Middle East, particularly surrounding Israel and so on and so forth, I think for me, you know, my suspicion is that the Iranians are going to be a very different case from the North Koreans if they do decide to cross those critical thresholds. For other proliferators, you know, what is the story of the North Korean precedent? This is a debate that, you know, I have quite a bit with non-proliferation analysts is, you know, is the North Korean tale a happy tale for a potential proliferator? And I don't think it is. Again, I think North Korea is really unique as a polity in its ability to tolerate the costs that were imposed on it externally for its decision to basically become a non-proliferation pariah, even in a way that I don't think is really applicable to Iran. I mean, if you compare North Korea and Iran as two different countries, I mean, Iran fundamentally is a lot more globally integrated of an economy than North Korea has ever aspired to be. And so a lot of the theory of our non-proliferation approach to North Korea has been to induce North Korea to walk away from the bomb by promising economic benefits. And that's just never worked because the North Koreans don't value that in the way that a country like Iran did, for instance, which I think allowed for the JCPOA and the JPOA talks to succeed in the way that they did. So I do continue to think that North Korea will be a little bit of a sui generis case for how we should think about deterring future proliferators, both potential allied proliferators and adversarial proliferators, at least for the United States, like Iran. That's where my thinking is for now, but I'm sure I need to dig deeper on this.
Ankit, as we wrap up this conversation today, I want to ask you a sort of slightly broader question about how you go about doing your research, because I think it would be very fascinating for our listeners and viewers to hear about this. You know, North Korea is one of the most opaque countries on the planet. And you just mentioned sick hackers' visits to North Korea. But you know, most Western researchers cannot go to North Korea. And if they can go, then the information that they'll be provided with will be highly controlled and curated. And I suppose you could argue that studying nuclear weapons development will be difficult in any context because nuclear weapons are, you know, a very sensitive topic. But it must be especially hard in the North Korean case. So can you talk a little bit about how you go about doing that kind of research and dealing with that kind of problem set?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really good question. I think it's important to take the North Koreans seriously, but not literally, right? So they actually put out a lot of information in the world from, you know, speeches by Kim Jong-un, like the January 2021 speech on modernization, which is about 14,000 words, the longest speech by any North Korean leader on nuclear modernization. I actually like to compare it to kind of Kim's version of Putin's March 1st, 2018 speech when he sort of unveils Russia's kind of strategic, exotic strategic weapons. But so, you know, that can be a very useful source to derive at least North Korean intentions, some of the strategic language that North Korea uses. Similarly, we have sort of North Korean laws on the country's nuclear forces and doctrine, you know, broadly analogous to doctrinal documents in other countries. High resolution imagery, videos are a very good source of insight into the provenance of some of North Korea's systems, even the strategic intention behind some of North Korea's weapon systems. And so there's a wealth of kind of open source knowledge that can be pulled on. Of course, recognizing that anything the North Koreans voluntarily put out into the world comes with quite a bit of baggage, right? There's internal propaganda value, there's external propaganda value, there's signaling value. And so as an analyst, you have to sort of be able to taxonomize that and be able to really pull the signal from the noise where possible. Other open source techniques that I think have revolutionized the study of North Korea in the last decade or so include the wide availability of commercial satellite imagery, which is a tool that I've also relied on to draw certain conclusions about what the North Koreans are up to. Obviously, I can't tell you everything. So holistically, I think combining these open source tools can actually give you a pretty good picture of what is happening in North Korea. And, you know, some of that stuff I talked about doctrine, strategy, leadership intent, You know, North Korea is actually not the most opaque state among all the nuclear weapon states when it comes to those kinds of statements. Because they've had this premium on credibility, deterrence is an act of communication at its core. And so for the North Koreans, communicating these capabilities to the outside world has been quite integral. And then the other thing I do in the book is to, of course, relate what the North Koreans are doing uniquely to the more general observations that we can take from the history of nuclear weapons strategy development in the U.S.-Soviet context and in other contexts. There are simply some sources of, I think, inductive insight that we can draw about, given a country's predicament and strategic concerns, what are the choices that we might expect to see from that country, right? So, you know, tactical nuclear weapons, when I was writing the book before Kim had articulated an overt interest in tactical nuclear weapons, I sort of made the observation that, look, North Korea is in a very similar predicament strategically to NATO in the 1960s, to the Pakistanis vis-a-vis India, right? Territorially contiguous, conventionally superior adversary, nuclear weapons are an offset. And that's exactly the way in which they've gone about thinking about their tactical nuclear weapons problem. So they also do, I think, learn from other cases. And then the final source of insight is, of course, talking to people in government who know things. Because, I used to be a journalist, so that was, again, part of the process in reporting the book. So tried to sort of piece together what I could from that combination of sources. And I think that continues to be a useful way to understand North Korea, especially as insight is more limited than it was in the past. In the past, at least, it was easy to also talk to foreign diplomats in Pyongyang, to sort of people who were there traveling for a variety of reasons. And now that is completely out of the picture in many ways.
Ankit, you're teeing up perfectly our final question today, which has to do with the relationship actually between sort of the academic community, the scholarly community, and the policymaking community. We always ask our guests when they come in the show sort of how they think about bridging that divide. I wonder if you can kind of finish us off here by telling us a little bit about the ways that you think that those two communities can relate to one another, the issues where you think that kind of engagement is the most important, and sort of how we go about doing that a little bit more effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I'm not an academic, and I sit squarely in the policy space as a non-governmental analyst. But I think the most important thing I take away and sort of admire from academia, at least, is thinking carefully about methods and ways of knowing, right? Kind of the epistemological problems that are at the core of this very difficult thing we all like to study, which is, this, as Hannah said, this very opaque set of issues around nuclear strategy, doctrine, force structure, et cetera, not just with North Korea, but elsewhere. And so evidentiary standards, I think, are really important, right? And I think this is a common frustration, I think, for many of us based here in Washington is, sitting in on meetings and hearing, frankly, statements made about countries like Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, that aren't necessarily based in a clear empirical basis, right? And I think that's really important. It's important as analysts to have that empirical basis for what we choose to believe. I think that's something that I've admired, for instance, about how many of the folks doing this work in the intelligence community operate, right? Because their job, of course, is to give policymakers who have certain priors about the world the actual intelligence on which to make certain decisions. And so that, I think, is the big thing that I think about a lot. It's especially important with dealing with, I think, increasingly opaque countries that are at the core of global, nuclear risks today. And so understanding, does Russia have a escalate to de-escalate strategy? What are the sources that we can read? Who are the people we can talk to understand, how deeply ingrained this might be in military thinking? It's important. And I just think that resisting that temptation in the policy community to basically have a set of views about the world and then cook the evidence to sort of support that, while tempting, I think can lead to bad policy outcomes ultimately. So I think that's really the big thing that we can kind of take from the academic community primarily. And of course, I think academics could do a better job of communicating with policymakers. That's something there's all this great work that happens in academia, but unless it's framed in a policy relevant way, policy relevance can, of course, I don't think that's really a good principle for what work should be done. I think work that isn't policy relevant should be done, because we don't know what the future holds, and work that's not relevant today might be very relevant a few years or decades from now. But communication, I think, is very important, right? And so framing ideas, how ideas are framed matters. For instance, you know, we talked about risk reduction earlier. I think in this greater environment of insecurity more generally, I think in order to talk about things like risk reduction and arms control, advocates of these ideas need to take insecurity seriously, right? So beginning from the premise that, you know, risk reduction and arms control are desirable ends, they can stabilize deterrence, you know, while I share those views, I think there is a need to sort of explain to policymakers and military planners why these are useful tools to actually manage the sources of insecurity that they perceive. So, you know, you might have noticed when I was talking about some of the proposals I had on risk reduction, it was very much related to the existing framing of deterrence of North Korea. And so how do you maintain deterrence without adding to unnecessary risks? So I think that's a really useful way to also frame ideas and have them be at least more appealing for a policy crowd. So I guess, yeah, just a few thoughts on kind of both sides of that.
Ankit, I think that's the perfect wrap. So I want to thank you for joining Sarah and me on today's episode to talk to us about North Korea. And to our listeners and viewers, I'll just say that Sarah and I will be recording a number of episodes this spring and into the summer for season 2 of Machiavelli in the Ivory Tower. So do stay tuned for those. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for having me.